Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Chukat. This week, Rabbi Daniel Landes discusses Chukat. Rabbi Daniel Landes is the director and Rosh HaYeshiva of the Pardes Institute. And now, Rabbi Daniel Landes.
Thank you, Larry. Today we have a fascinating parsha. The Parsha of Chukat. Vayedaber Adonai Moshe v'al Aharon l'emor, the Lord spoke to, at the very beginning, to Moshe and to Aharon, saying, this is how the Parsha begins, Zod Chukat Torah asher tiva Adonai l'emor, Daber b'nei Yisrael v'iklu eilecha para aduma t'mima, asher ein ba mum, asher lo aleha ol, all those ayins there. This is the statute of the Torah, the Chukah, that the Lord God, that the Lord has commanded you, saying, speak to the children of Israel, and you shall take for yourself, this is for the community as a whole, a red heifer, timima, perfect, asher ein bamum, that has no blemish, and which has not been placed upon it a yoke. The notion of that it should be red, completely red, timima. If two hairs within a very large expanse of the hairs of the animal, if you can find two hairs which are not red, two black, two white hairs, it's invalidated. No, you cannot dye it. And it has to be something that has no blemish, like several other korbanot. It has no blemish at all. And it can never have had a yoke upon it. The notion of yoke is actually really has been limited to the egla arufa, to the broken heifer that the neck that we break in the case of the egla arufa is the case of which a man or woman is found dead, and in the outskirts of a city, we measure which is the closest city, and then the notables of that city come forth and do a ritual expiating sin that never took care of this person as the person was on their way. They take personal responsibility as a way of expiating that type of sin. And in that case, it says it cannot have ever had a yoke upon it. But the difference there is, halachically, that if a yoke was ever put upon it, but it never plowed, just a yoke was placed upon it, it still is kosher for the Egla Arufa, for the broken neck ceremony. However, in this case, according to halacha, there was never any yoke upon it. So even if a yoke was placed on for some ceremonial reason or a person changed their mind, it's too late. If a person ever leaned upon it, upon this animal to get his bearings or to cross a river, already this is considered to have done work. And in other words, and therefore it's thrown out. It really has to be perfect in all sorts of ways. One more verse. Unatem otah el ozor kohen should be given to Elzor the kohen. Votzi otah michutzel machaneh v'shechad otah lefanav, and he shall take it outside of the camp, and he shall slaughter it there. Being outside the camp is also very rare, that the slaughtering does not take place in the mishkan and later on the mikdash area, in the tabernacle area, or later on in the temple area. This is considered to be a chok, a chukah. A statute. We don't understand the reasons. It's ne'elam mimenu. It's far away from us. And the laws are strange laws. And one of the strange laws that is expressed by the commentators and saying that we don't understand it, right off the bat, and we see in Rabbeinu Bachya, is that the Paraduma has a very strange dynamic. Shehi metaheret et ha-tmeim, umetamet et oskim bavodata, that it through its process of slaughtering, burning the ashes, and sprinkling the ashes on a person who is tamei, a person who is impure, tamei mate, who is impure because he or she has contracted the highest degree of impurity, which is contact with a dead human being, the para aduma. It gives purity. It purifies those who have the worst situation of impurity, which is contact with the dead. But here's the improbable nature. Umetamet et oskim bavodata. Umetamet et harim. It renders impure, unclean, those who have done the ceremony, not the beneficiaries, but those who participate in the slaughtering and the burning and the sprinkling of the water mixed with the ashes. And you have this improbable and difficult to understand, and seemingly from a commentator is impossible to understand situation of this kind of dynamic. So I'm not here to explain it today, but I am here because we all struggle with it, is to understand its impact. When it says the word chukah, chok, we say statute, something which is ne'elam mimenu, something which is very difficult for us to understand, or it disappears from us, not clear to us, never be clear to us, perhaps. Chukah also means something, chok is something chakak, something which is deeply engraved. I'd like to say that a chok is part of those things which are part of the deep structure of our consciousness. It's not something just easily understandable, or something merely symbolic, which the symbols become very clear to us. But it seems to strike very, very, very deep into how our religion and how our Judaism is expressed, and it has that kind of repercussions for the ages. So a hint of how to go in this direction I found in the early commentary of the Ramban in this parish of Nachmanides. Nachmanides, in almost like an off way, relates it in different manners to different halachot and mentions the halacha or set of halachot of the Seir HaMishtaleach, of the Yom Kippur ritual that's done in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle, later in the Mikdash, of sending away the scapegoat to Azazel, to the wilderness, to its hellish end in the desert, sent by the Ishiti, the man who takes him. And actually, there is a real symbolic parallel in general between what takes place in this parasha with the Yom Kippur ritual. If one looks in the Talmudic section, but here we'll take a look at its summary in the Rambam, that the Rambam Maimonides, in his Laws of Parah Adumah, found in the section of Tahara, of purity, which is found in his Mishnah Torah, his redoing of Jewish law, his major code. And he says, Ma'alot yeterot of subatarat paraduma, that they went to great yeterot, ma'alot yeterot, terrific number of degrees, ma'alot, or ascents, precautions, taking things to a higher level. So we can say, ma'alot yeterot are extensive levels of precaution and of carefulness were done. And maybe yeterot almost sounds, in number also seems to see almost extensive, and almost seems to say overly extensive. But of course, the Rambam says it's halacha that they did regarding this whole sanctification ritual of the paraduma and harchakot gedolot herchiku. They made sure that things would be very far from the impurity of the dead and everything that took place until it came to its slam-bang conclusion, in which the person who was tame, impure, becomes pure, and the person who was pure becomes impure. And this is what they did. And they made sure that they were mafrish, that they separated the Kohen. The Kohen, and sometimes it was Kohen Gadol, but the designated Kohen, who was to burn, to slaughter and to burn, and to do this ritual, and they would separate him out for 7 days to a special spot within the temple courtyard. does it just like we did, and that's the connection with the Kohen Gadol, who is going to do the Yom Kippur service. And for him to do the Yom Kippur service, as you remember, it's the same thing. They were mafrishim. They separated him out and put him in a special spot for 7 days. And the laws are very, very similar. Of course, there's one major distinction, and that is Yom Kippur has a specific date. So that particular attention of making sure that we have the Kohen Gadol completely pure and completely ready for his service on Yom Kippur, on the day that Yom Kippur is going to fall, that produces a certain type of stress. Here, there's the same sort of precaution. I think the stress level is not the same stress level, because if it doesn't work for one day, you could always slaughter and burn the Parah Adumah another day. However, there's still a stress. It was an extraordinarily important ceremony, and there's always a fear that something will happen to the Parah Adumah, will happen to this red heifer. What happens if it sprouts a couple of hairs that are a different color? It's out. What happens if someone somehow leans on it or treats it in the improper way, so it no longer has not born a yoke? It's born some form of yoke, literal yoke, or the general notion of yoke. Or what happens if it just stumbles and hurts itself and bruises itself so badly, or breaks a limb? Then we're done for, and that's no work. So there's a stress there also. But we separate the Kohen to a special spot in the temple courtyard, and for 7 days. And they made sure that the whole area where he would stay was constructed of stone. And it was constructed of stone so that he would in no way have contact with any utensil. A stone does not contract impurity. A stone cannot become impure. So as a result, everything there was made out of stones. She'ein mekablim tumah, because they do not contract impurity. And indeed, all the utensils that he used to use for those 7 days of separation were also made of stone. Here in this situation, it's even more extreme than the case of the Kohen Gadol for Yom Kippur. And he would not touch anybody else. He would be really separated, even more so from touching anybody, so they could not contract any sort of impurity. And he kept 7 days away from his wife, because perhaps she would be a menstruant without her knowledge, and then that he would contract that impurity of menstruation, and he would have to again his whole being designated to do this work would be for naught. And one of the things that they did for him in these 7 days, in this case it's just like the Kohen Gadol, he would spend each day he would have from previous red heifers, the ashes of previous red heifers mixed in water, they would sprinkle on him. It wasn't a torrential sprinkle, it was a torrential pouring. It was just a little bit of a sprinkle. He would have be sprung on him this water of the mei chatat, the mei nida chatat, this water of sprinkling, which would be spread upon him, sprinkled upon him, to take him out from being tamei. And they would do this for 7 days, and they would construct, because as it is, it was always done for a person who was tamei. They would always do it on the third day and on the seventh day. That was the ritual, how it was done. He would also be done on the third day and on the seventh day of this cycle. So he had the same cycle of those whom he later on would prepare the water from which they would be sprinkled and they would be taken care of. That's how it would be done. They would construct the cycle of him being there so that his fourth day of being there, which technically, if you count up the days, it's probably the day that he could not be Tomei mate, that he could not be impure from having knowingly or unknowingly touched a dead person. They would make sure that they fell on Shabbat, and that Shabbat there would be no sprinkling ceremony, but that's how he would spend his seven days. That is a very strong notion of preparation and consideration in which both the Kohen Gadol and for Yom Kippur service and the Kohen, and who may very well be Kohen Gadol, the high priest, would have for the preparation of the red heifer. That's one great parallel. The other great parallel, I like to say, is that a very, very important part of the ceremony in Yom Kippur is the sending away of the scapegoat. Now, you remember, we have two goats, and we're not sure which goat will remain for a sacrifice within the temple area, and which goat would be sent forth as a scapegoat. And the Kohen Gadol the high priest would have this kind of lottery in which he would find out, and it would be, as it were, by chance, sheer by chance, which of the goats would have what fate. And one would be L'Shamayim, one would be Azazel, one would be taken to be slaughtered within the temple by the Kohen Gadol himself, and the other would be taken away by an individual outside the camp. And that scapegoat was then taken away and taken far away. The Parah Adumah itself is slaughtered outside the camp. Isn't that interesting? It's slaughtered outside the camp. It's slaughtered in the northeast of the Azarah, of the temple area, outside. And that's where also it's burnt outside. It's as if everything that is has to do, because it allows those who are involved, who contract impurity, allows them to be impure outside of the Mikdash arena. When we have these comparisons, just as the scapegoat itself is outside and meets its fate outside the temple. So let me suggest this as a comparison between the two. The two great notions of alienation in life are sin and death. Sin is the great alienating factor. By sinning, we alienate ourselves from God. We seek, when we are our better part of ourselves, we seek to come closer to God again. There's a barrier. We need atonement. We need a way to return. The whole Yom Kippur ritual is one of allowing a sinner, as part of a group, to come back to God. We have various factors involved. And, of course, the individual's personal determination to do tshuva is very important. But we have a ritual, and a very strong ritual, that involves the scapegoat, sending away the goat, which bears upon himself all the sins of the people. That in a metaphorical sense, he becomes the concrete object of that sin. The confession of the high priest upon this animal allows him to bear it, and as we see him go far away, and we see him go outside the machaneh, go outside the camp, we understand that perhaps our sins can be taken away, and that's part of an essential part of the ritual. Another great alienating fact of life, of course, is death. Death is alienating because we're in death, there's no meaning, especially when we feel that, or seemingly no meaning. Death is a crisis for us. When a loved one dies, it's impossible even to say the Shema Yisrael at that moment because we are not in touch. The world's in chaos, and how can we talk about oneness? It's utter absurdity and fragmentation. Of course, once a person is buried, the very first thing we do is to utter the Kaddish, which talks about the unity, and it's a unity theme. But before that happens, death itself, it comes to us with such a blow of absurdity, of crisis, of nullity, and of the lack of meaning. It takes us outside the camp. It takes us outside of ourselves. It's a separation between ourselves and God. It's a separation between ourselves with ourselves. We look at ourselves and say, so what is it worth? And how can we find our own meaning, and how can we have a struggle back? And it seems like it's impossible to happen. And I think these are the two parallels of the notion of uh, of uh, of sin and of death. And the reason why I mention death is because the tumad, the impurity that we're talking about is tumat mate, is the impurity of death. We feel the impurity of death. And even when it's not a loved one, even if it's just we are there and we touch a person who has been dead, even if we're doing it for the best possible reason, that we're attending to the person died, or we're attending the person after they died, it's impossible. Halacha, Jewish law, Jewish teachings does not allow us to avoid the existential feeling of nothingness. It says this is what you feel, this is perhaps what you need to feel. You are removed from yourself. Tuma, therefore, impurity in many ways, is a functional definition of separation, of lack of integration. And the ritual of being sprinkled by the water of the Para Aduma is really a ritual of bringing us forward from nothingness to nothingness to meaning, just as the notion of sin and is a notion of lack of meaning and bring us back into integration with God. And what it says about the Sa'ir HaMishtalech, that scapegoat, is a very important verse. It says about the Sa'ir HaMishtalech, Vayitah zot lachem chukat olam, but the scapegoat, it should be for you a chok, an engraved statute forever. It's not just, we don't understand sin. We don't understand the power of its alienation. We can appreciate it, but we don't fully understand it. That's a chok. This is what is part of our consciousness. It's engraved in us. And the same thing with the tumah of the notion of impurity of death. And the two are really parallel to each other. And of course, it goes to a deeper degree. And the deeper degree is hinted by the Ramban. He just says it almost as a off comment that he speaks about at the beginning of Chukat. He speaks, I've already written in connection with the goat that sent away to Azazel, that were taunted by the nations because they don't understand the reason for this. And they, just as they taunt us about the procedure of the red heifer. And he speaks about the two in the same notion, is that actually what we have here is that we know that that all sin in the end is a cause of death. That sin is a cause of alienation, that the greatest sin is the unjust ending of life. That's the greatest sin of all. And that type of sin and that of death is, and this is what he says, the reason for the impurity conveyed by a corpse, I'm quoting from the Nachmanides, from Ban, the reason for the impurity conveyed by a corpse is due to man's sin committed through the instigation of the serpent, the original sin. Those who died by divine kiss, he goes, those who are complete tzaddikim, they don't have impurity even in their body, but the rest of us have it. And so we have here these two comparisons, and what we have here is the desire to overcome it, the desire to take it seriously. Death is not trivial, and the impurity that we feel within ourselves by connection with death, whether we cause it, God forbid, whether or not we are a personal mourner, we should not be mourners only. It should be limited, and it's a terrible thing, but it happens. Or if it's a stranger, we should not in any way be callous about this. It makes us feel that we're alienated. It makes us feel that the world is absurd. And therefore sin, and the greatest sin of all, is the sin of somehow causing death in the world. And sin itself is the reason, according to our teachings, for death. Sin cuts us off. How do we overcome sin? And these things come together in the ritual. And why does the priest who is able to help others through the purification ritual, why is that person himself, having gone through that, why does he himself become tameh? Why does he himself become impure? Why this incredible, improbable just anti-logical notion that the one who brings purity becomes impure, I think that's actually how it works. Consider the fact that when you help someone, if you help someone through a traumatic situation, if you help them bring someone together and all the rest, you yourself are affected by that change, even when you are successful. And therefore, the therapists often themselves need some help afterwards to make sure they're on the right track. The rabbi who has to decide a halachic decision in a difficult case in order to lead someone towards a Torah direction, he himself, she herself, has to think through again afterwards, where do they actually stand? They themselves need a transformative moment, and that's true with educators and it's true with parents. And therefore, I think this is a chok. I don't fully understand it, but I think this is the way the world is. The great, great, positive, wonderful lesson of this parsha is that alienation is not forever. That alienation is true. Alienation happens. It validates our feelings of alienation. It gives us realm to express alienation. It tells us not to be callous and that alienation is logical in its absurdity. The alienation comes when we know we have sinned, and alienation comes when we know that we have come close to death and have had a brush with death, and it tells us to experience it and understand it, and tells us it's not the last word, that God is always able to sprinkle upon us if our hearts are willing and our minds are active and our bodies are ready to do the actions, all ready to sprinkle upon us those waters of purity. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Landes. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you on the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.